Right, we're reading from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, starting at verse 27, and you can find it on page 713 of the Bibles in front of you. That's chapter 8, verses 27 to 38. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Christ." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels."
Thank you very much, Matthew. Geraldine, lovely to see you arrive safely. You just missed your moment, I'm afraid, but great to see that you've arrived. It'd be great help to me if you could keep your Bibles open there at Mark chapter 8. We're going to look at that passage together. And in the little server sheets you were given, you'll see there's something of an outline of where we're going, space to write notes or draw pictures or doodle or do whatever you like with there. And before we look at that passage together, I'm going to pray. So let me just pray. Oh, gracious God, we thank you that you're not hiding. You've not left us guessing about what you're like as a God, but you have spoken. You've given us your word. And we pray now as we look at it together that by your Spirit you would open our eyes, that we would see more of your Son. Amen. Jesus of Nazareth never owned a home. He never travelled further than about 200 miles from the place where he was born. He never led an army. He never held political office. He never even wrote a book. Yet his impact on world history has been quite staggering. H.G. Wells wrote, "I'm a historian, not a believer, but I must confess as a historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all history," says H.G. Wells. I don't know what you think about that. You may not go quite as far as Wells. But it's very striking, isn't it? Every time we write the date, we remember that Jesus is the one by whom we measure our days. 2,011 years since what? Since Jesus. And it's not just our calendar. It's our whole culture that's been shaped by him. He was the one who taught us to love our enemies. He was the one who made it possible to forgive rather than take revenge. He's the one who tears down all the barriers of race and class and gender, and who insists all people are equal. He's the one who warned us not to be judgmental. He's the one who showed us what it means to be humble. The poet Tennyson said of Jesus's, he said of Jesus, the greatest miracle is his character. His character is extraordinary. Even Bertrand Russell, famous atheist philosopher, said that if we would all be like Jesus, this world would be paradise. And really, for the past 2,000 years or so, the world's greatest thinkers have been captivated by him. They have wrestled with what to make of him. What do you make of a man like this? But in our generation, it seems to me I meet more and more people who have never really given him a second thought. Not really. Not thoroughly investigated his claims as an adult. And that's partly because we live in a generation that thinks that religion is the whole area of life for which there is no real evidence. So for most people, religion comes under the same category as kind of stamp collecting or Latin American dance. You know, it's just what some people are into in their spare time. And just as not exactly everyone is into train spotting, not exactly everyone is into Jesus Christ. I am hugely into fly fishing. If you're not, I don't suppose you think, you know, as a matter of integrity, I really ought to make a thorough investigation of fly fishing before I come to any conclusions about it. You just look at it, and you look at these people standing there in their waders and their wide-brimmed hats looking ridiculous, and you think, nah, doesn't appeal. And the danger is that is how we approach Jesus Christ. We look at him from a distance, and we look at these people, and we go, nah, doesn't appeal. But what I want to argue is that the kind of claims that Jesus makes are the kind of claims that demand thorough investigation. Bloke comes rushing in right now. Says, I've just had a call from the police. There is a bomb in this building. What would we do? How would you feel if I said, well, you know, thank you, we're okay, thanks. We're good. We'll just carry on as we are because bombs in buildings are just not our thing. We're just not that kind of, you know, group of people. Be a little frustrated with me, I think. The person rushing in is not asking if this was an idea that some of us might sort of be into. He's making a claim about reality that has serious implications for everyone in the room. We might think it highly unlikely, but I think we'd at least sort of get up and shuffle out and get the whole thing checked out, would we? It may turn out to be a hoax, but we just can't afford to ignore a claim like that. You need to check it out. Life and death are at stake. And if we think Jesus is saying, here's an idea that some of you might be interested in, then he's very easy to ignore. But what he's doing is he's making a bomb in the building sort of a claim. He's making a claim about reality that has serious implications for everyone in the room. Life and death are at stake. Which means it is the kind of claim we at very least need to check out. And Mark chapter 8 gives us a flavor of the kind of claim Jesus makes. And I want to look at it and then leave plenty of time for some of the questions that you may have. First thing we see is Jesus' identity as God's king. Look again at verse, where is it, 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked them, who do people say I am? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others, one of the prophets. See, John the Baptist, Elijah, some kind of prophet. That's what people say you are. Prophet was someone who pointed to God's king. And if we want to know about God's king, we need to go back to the Old Testament where it's all set up for us. The Old Testament, the Jews of the Old Testament believe that their God was the creator of the whole world, which means he's not just their private little God, their little God for them. He was the one true God for all people of all nations. And the promise this God makes near the very beginning of the Bible is that through this one particular people, through Israel, he is going to reach out to all people in the world. And in particular, the Old Testament says God will do this through his king, the Messiah. And the Greek word for Messiah is the Christ. And through this Christ, he was going to put this whole broken world back together again. And he was going to set up a kingdom over which this Christ would reign forever. And it would be a wonderful kingdom. There'd be no more fighting. There'd be no more fear. There'd be no more funerals, no more farewells. There'd be no broken homes and no broken hearts. Every tear would be wiped dry forever. It'd be wonderful. Only the question was, what sort of king is the Old Testament talking about? What sort of king has power to put a whole broken world back together again? What sort of king can reign forever? And by the end of the Old Testament, the prophets say, the one they're waiting for, this king who's going to come, is God himself. It's God himself we're waiting for. The Lord is the one we're getting ready for. And many people looking at Jesus from a distance, I guess they agree with what the disciples are reporting here. They thought that Jesus was just another prophet, pointing to the king who was to come. I guess many people today, that's their kind of take on Christianity. Jesus is just another prophet pointing to God. But Jesus won't leave it at that. He gets personal. You see, look at verse 27. Who do people say I am? Verse 28, they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others one of the prophets. Verse 29, but what about you, he asked. Who do you say I am? It's a much harder question to answer. This isn't just, do you think anyone will marry me? This is, will you marry me? There's a whole lot more hinges on your answer. And Peter says, do you see in verse 29? Peter answered, you are the Christ. You're the king. You're the king. You're not just another prophet pointing to him. You're him. In other words, in Peter's mind, the last 3 years watching Jesus are all coming together. It all started when John the Baptist stood up and said, get ready, get ready. The one we're waiting for is coming. And everyone's going, where? And up steps, carpenter's son from Nazareth. It's a big letdown. This is our God. This is the great king we've been waiting for. Carpenter's son from Nazareth. But the very first thing Jesus does is he goes into a synagogue and he reads out the bit in the prophet where God says he's going to come and put this broken world back together again. And Jesus reads it out and then he rolls it up and he says, this day, that scripture is fulfilled. The day you've been waiting for has come because I'm here. People are thinking, what? But that was something God was going to do. But Jesus goes on. One time he heals a bloke on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees say, you shouldn't do that. Only God can work on the Sabbath. And Jesus says, my Father is working and I'm working. He says, God is working, so do I. I do what God does. And that may not sound much of a big deal to us, but the Pharisees got the point exactly. It says they were outraged because he was making himself equal with God. He was saying, well, if God can do it, I can do it. See? Another time he claimed to forgive sins. And the Pharisees were furious. They said, who can forgive sin but God alone? And they were quite right. See, often people pigeonhole Jesus as a good teacher. But the striking thing is the people of the day who first heard him didn't think he was a good teacher at all. They were outraged by the sort of claims he kept making for himself. He kept putting himself on God's side of the line. Good teachers don't go around making out that they are equal with God. So they picked up stones and they threw them at him. But his outrageous claims were kind of underlined by his extraordinary deeds. The miracles are not kind of party tricks. They were signs that point to who he is. So the prophets had said, when this king comes, he would restore sight to the blind, the lame would walk, the lepers would be cleansed. And this is what Jesus went round doing. Why? To show he's the one come to put this broken world back together again. One time they're out in a boat and storm blew up and the disciples were terrified. They think they're going to drown. And Jesus just stands up and says a word and the sea sits down, totally calm. And you'd think the disciples would be relieved. But it says they were even more terrified. Who is this man, they said, who even the wind and the waves obey him? See, the only person they knew who had power over the sea, the wind and the waves, was God. In the Old Testament, God saved his people from the sea. And Jesus is saying, do you see who I am? I'm the one with power to save you. Another time, a 12-year-old girl had just died, and Jesus says to her parents, trust me. And he goes into her bedroom, and he says, little girl, I say to you, get up. Just like her parents had done every morning before that one, to get her moving for school. Get up. She's dead. But she gets up, restored. And the people are amazed and a little afraid, because in the Old Testament, the only person who could give life to the dead was God. Who is this man? And Peter gets it. You are the Christ. You're the king we've been waiting for. And when they got who he was, these Jewish people like Peter, they didn't just respect him, they worshipped him. And I remember being very struck by that. Because these are people who were brought up to know in their blood that the only one worthy of worship was the Lord their God. And what do they do to Jesus? They don't just respect him, they worship him. See, as they look at him, they see that the only language that describes this man, that's big enough to describe this man, is God language. Do you remember when Thomas falls before Jesus and says, my Lord and my God? And Jesus doesn't tell him to stop being so embarrassing. Jesus accepts it. Because that's the conclusion everyone is meant to come to. Do you see why this is a claim we can't afford to ignore? When the Lord, who they were waiting for, came, he wasn't going to be a man with one or two ideas that some people might find a little bit interesting. He was going to be God come to restore the whole world and rule over it forever. But that is a claim about reality that has an impact on not just everyone in this room, but everyone in the whole world. It's a claim that needs to be checked out. That the one conclusion you can't come to is that it's a nice thing for some people who are into that kind of thing. It is either utter rubbish or it's true. And if it's true, it changes everything, because it means this world has a king who calls me to recognize him. Who do you say I am? His identity, God's king. His mission, God's rescuer. I guess one of the reasons Jesus doesn't seem to be worth bothering with, is because we've got him down as a teacher. It's like, you know, you may be a brilliant trumpet teacher, and that's great and everything, but I don't need you because I don't want to learn the trumpet. See, Jesus may be a brilliant religious teacher, but I don't really need him because I'm not really into religion. But here is the very striking thing. Jesus says he has not come to teach. He's not come to teach religion to people who might be a little bit interested in religion. He's come to rescue. Jesus says, look, now you've got who I am. This is what I have come to do. Look at verse 31. He began to teach them that the Son of Man is his way of talking about himself. Again, it's another Old Testament title he applies to himself. And he says, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. You see, he wants them to get that he's not just come to teach religion. He's come to do something. He's saying, you know, my mission means I must, what? Be killed and rise again. It's very strange, isn't it? But it's a theme you meet again and again in the Gospels. See, we think his being killed looks like it's all gone wrong. It's all come to nothing. It's just another reason for not taking him seriously. But again and again, Jesus says, this is why I've come. I must be killed. And we're thinking, what kind of a rescue mission is that? When we try and live without recognizing the king, when we just do our own thing, that's what the Bible calls sin. And in our age, we think sin is a kind of joke. It's sort of trivial thing. God says, no, sin is no joke. It's very serious. Sin is the reason our world is such a mess. It's doing our own thing that leads to broken countries and broken homes and broken hearts. And in the end, it's doing our own thing that leads to death, cut off from life with God forever. Jesus, that's the danger we need rescuing from. And so, well, how does his death rescue us from death? How does his death rescue us from our death, our being cut off from God? And again, it's the Old Testament that makes sense of what is going on. Do you remember the sacrifices in the Old Testament? God gave his people a system of sacrifices to show them how he was going to rescue them. And through the sacrifices, God was teaching his people that sin is serious. So the priest would look at all the people and say, our sin is serious. Our sin deserves death. But then the priest would kind of lay his hands on an animal. And he would say, let your sin be transferred to this animal. And the animal would then be killed. And the priest would then turn to the people and say, your sins have all been paid for. You're forgiven. You're restored to God. But this whole system of sacrifices was just a kind of signpost pointing forward to what God would one day come to do. And when he came, he would rescue his people from sin once and for all. And that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying, I have come to be the lamb that is going to be sacrificed. I must be killed because I have come to pay for your sin so that you can be forgiven, so that you can be restored to God, restored to life with him. The great German theologian Martin Luther said, if you want to understand the Christian message, you must start with the wounds of Christ. And I think the reason our generation doesn't really get Jesus is because we really don't get his death. And friends, I know this whole language of sacrifice and paying for sin sounds very strange to our 21st century ears. But at very least, do you see what it says about the King of the universe? At very least, do you see that it says that he loves us? See, because what it says is we were in danger. And he loves us so much that he comes to our rescue, even though rescuing us meant laying down his life for us. But that's how much we matter to him. There's nothing we want more than to be loved. Isn't that what we crave more than anything else? We want to know we are loved. And if you hear a rumor of someone who loves you, at very least, you're kind of curious, aren't you, to find out more? The possibility of being loved is intriguing. And here is the King of the universe. And he's saying, he loves you. Isn't that a claim worth investigating? Of course, he could have just been another deluded guy. And that's why he goes on. Verse 31. He must be killed and after 3 days rise again. It's the resurrection. It's the fact that Jesus rose again that shows us that Jesus is for real. Because the fact is, if Jesus had not risen from the dead, you and I would never have heard of him. See, the disciples didn't get what Jesus was saying at all. See, look at verse 32. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Jesus, what are you talking about? Dying and rising from the dead? So when Jesus was crucified, do you remember what they did? When Jesus was crucified, they fled. They denied they ever even knew him. They didn't stand around saying, just you wait 3 days, then you'll see. Ha ha. They scarpered because it was all over. It was all over. They thought he was going to be God's king, but he couldn't be. Not now. Because God's king was going to reign forever, not be nailed to a cross. So they all go home. It's just another of the many people around that time who claimed that they were the Messiah and who were killed by the Romans in a very public manner. And, well, in every case, when they were killed, that was the end of it. Their followers realized they couldn't possibly be the Messiah. The idea of standing up in front of the crowds and preaching that Jesus, that man who was crucified, was in fact God's king over the universe, well, everyone would have laughed. He's not God's king over the universe. He'd been killed by the Romans. But just a few weeks after his crucifixion, that's what happened. The disciples stood up in Jerusalem on the steps of the temple, not far from where Jesus had been buried, and they said to the crowd of thousands, you know that Jesus who was crucified? He is the king of the universe. And the question is, what led them to say that? And the only answer that I can make any sense of is the resurrection. The only thing that would have got them up onto those steps, making those claims in front of that crowd, would have been the conviction that Jesus was alive. People often say, don't they? They say, well, the early church created the resurrection. No, the resurrection created the early church. If Jesus hadn't risen from the dead, the whole thing would have come to nothing. And if you're looking into this thing, that's one of the key questions to ask. How do you account for the turnaround in the disciples? His mission was not to teach people who might be interested, but to rescue people in danger. And the resurrection says that the mission didn't end in the failure of the cross. The resurrection says the cross was mission accomplished. So there is a claim that there is a bomb about to go off, and we're in danger, and there is a man who says he knows how to defuse it. Do you think that man is worth bothering with? You'd at least give him a go, wouldn't you? Final reason why his claims are worth checking out. And they're to do with his authority as God's judge. Look at verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. You see what Jesus is saying? He's saying, follow me. It's very striking. See, all the prophets said, follow God. Jesus stands there, calm as you like, and says, follow me. It's typical Jesus. He's the man for others. So he's always concerned about others. But what he most longs for others is that they follow him. So he's saying, the best thing anyone can do is to follow me. And you see the kind of language he uses. Following him is not just about having sort of passing interest in some of his teachings. He's saying, you've got to be ready to take up your cross for me. You've got to be ready to lose your life for me. Verse 37, or what could a man give in exchange for his soul? Sorry, verse 36. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? So you could have the whole world, but if you don't have me, he's saying, you lose your soul. You have nothing. Very striking language, isn't it? If we have him down as a just kind of mild-mannered man who just urged people to be a lot nicer to one another, you know, if that's all Jesus is about, pretty hard to get that worked up about him. But do you see what he's saying? He's saying, I am more important than anything else in your life. And you say, what kind of a person says stuff like this? And the answer is in verse 38. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. Son of Man, it's an Old Testament title for the judge of the universe. And Jesus is talking about himself. And he's saying, one day, when I come to judge the universe, your eternal destiny will hinge on where you stand with me. If you're ashamed of me now, I will be ashamed of you then. Very striking, isn't it? See, if we've got Jesus down as just a figure from the past, he's very easy to ignore. I mean, there are lots of figures from the past about whom I guess we don't know very much. Perhaps we might like to know more about a Plato or a Shakespeare or a Mozart or a Michelangelo or a Samuel Beckett or a John Lennon or a George Best. It'd be nice to know more about these people, but not essential. It's not life or death. And, I will never have to stand before any of those people and explain myself to them. But Jesus is saying he's not just a figure from the past. He's saying he's a figure of the future. He's alive. He's saying he is God's judge. And he's saying one day all of us will have to stand before him and explain ourselves to him. And the question he will ask on that day is this: what did you make of me? Were you ashamed of me? Or were you glad to be mine? So here is the claim. The claim is this: the King of the universe has come to rescue you because he loves you. And one day you will stand before him and give an account of what you did with his love. Did you accept it or reject it? Do you see the kind of claim it is? It's not the kind of claim that might be interesting for some people who are into that kind of thing. It is either utter rubbish or it's true. Either way, the stakes are so high. It's got to be worth checking out. You might say, but how? And the thing we want to say is, we're not asked to take a blind leap of faith. We're asked to come and see. Come and investigate. Come and ask the historians questions. Did he actually exist? Can we really trust these gospel accounts? Wasn't it all just legend that grew and grew and grew? Come ask your questions. And in a moment there'll be a chance to do some of that. Those questions, I've put some sort of ideas down on the sheet. Those questions or any others that you've got. So what we'll do now is what we normally do at Emmanuel each week. We just take a moment of quiet. Chance just to ponder some of these things a little bit. Chance to write down some of your questions on the post-it notes that are scattered around the place. And then we'll sing again. And during that song, there'll be some hats that will get passed around the room. Stick your questions in the hats, and then we'll gather them up and spend some time just working through them together. Okay, so a moment of quiet now just to kind of begin to formulate your questions. Thank you. I've asked Nicholas Brown just to kind of shuffle the questions and be a bit of a kind of chairperson for some of the questions. So, Nicholas, what have we got?
Well, as usual there, thank you, you can hear me. There are a lot of questions here. I've tried to divide them into bits about the passage, bits about who Jesus was, and bits about the reliability of the gospel. Broadly, it's those sort of three categories that people have asked. And I'll start with sort of Jesus as a person. First question, what did Jesus do for the first 30 years of his life?
We don't know terribly much about it, and that's what's quite striking, is that what we do know about Jesus is very focused on these three extraordinary years, and actually so much of the focus is on the last few weeks and the events surrounding his death. We have a snippet of his boyhood, As and we know that even as a 12-year-old boy, he used this phrase, "I'm about my father's business." He had a sense of, his special relationship with his father in heaven. But we don't know much more than that. We've got the birth narratives that we know from Christmas, a snippet of this incident when he was about a 12-year-old boy, and then really things get going with John the Baptist in the beginning of kind of 3 years of public ministry. Okay.
I should say, I'll give a chance for people to come back as well. Maybe if you ask the question, or you ask the question on behalf of a friend, as we said, Emmanuel, then would there be a chance to sort of wander around and just raise your hand, and I'll give a chance for people to come back and perhaps explore that a bit more. But just continuing on the theme of who Jesus was, it says, it seems like a risky plan, this next question, to put yourself into such an innocuous place on earth. God as the son of a carpenter. Why do it like that?
That's a very perceptive question. It's a strange plan, isn't it? It's a plan that you and I would never have come up with, because I think when we think of power, we think we'll use power to kind of sort everything out by flattening everyone. And God, the one with all the power in the universe, says, I will come and I'll use my power to serve and to lay down my life for people. I guess what it shows us is the character of God. So strange to us, we'd say, well, we would never have done it like that. We would have got the tanks in. But God says, no, I love these people, and I'm going to lay down my life for them. And it seems to me there are two ways you can deal with rebellion. You can put it down, you can flatten it. You know, what are they going to do in Egypt at the moment? How do you deal with rebellion? You can put it down brutally, or you can find a way of restoration and reconciliation. And that's the way that God has gone for, and it's a way that cost him enormously. And I guess that's always true when you forgive someone who has wronged you. Costly thing.
Okay, thank you. And the last question I'll ask on sort of who Jesus was, and why does the resurrected Jesus reveal himself just to a few select people and not to the majority of people?
What's interesting is when Paul writes his letter, he talks about how Jesus appeared, that he did appear to select individuals. There are also occasions when he appears to crowds, big crowds. So there's a time when Paul says, look, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, our faith is in vain. We can all go home. It's a waste of time. And he says, actually, Jesus appeared to crowds. And he said, some of them are still alive. Go and speak with them. So the appearances of Jesus weren't just sort of private mystical experiences. They're what you might call public experiences, the kind of experiences where whole groups of people saw him. So I think that there is that sort of crowd dimension to things. It isn't just kind of behind closed doors, sort of private individuals having sort of, you know, maybe perhaps slightly sort of mystical experiences that got confused. It was the kind of thing that happened to groups of people and crowds of people. And that's why the claims from right at the beginning of the first Christians made very public claims. They didn't just say, we've had this kind of experience that it's kind of hard to explain. They said, the tomb is empty, we've all seen Jesus alive. You go, check it out yourself. There's a sort of public nature of the claims that they made, which I remember being very struck by when I looked into it.
Okay. I said that would be the end. There is one last question which I've seen. I think it's a great question. Can we really believe that Jesus led a life without sin? It's unrealistic for us, and it's just disappointing if we fail.
So what was that last thing?
I'll read it as it's written. It says, can we really believe that Jesus led a life without sin? It is unrealistic for us, and it's just disappointing if we fail.
Yeah. I suppose there are two halves to that, which is, can we really believe that Jesus led a life without sin? That's the wonder of Jesus, is that there is no one else who gets a right... But Peter, Jesus' friend, in one of the letters he writes, talks about Jesus never committing a sin, never hurt anyone with anything he did or anything he said. There's no one else in history who sort of gets a write-up like that, that washes. I think that's what's down the ages people have been so fascinated by. The sort of extraordinary purity of Jesus. No hint of sin. But the second part of the observation was important, is that disappointing for us? Well, on one level it is, because we recognise in the light of Jesus that we are not... Jesus shows us what it is to be fully human. And actually we realise in the light of Jesus we're not. We fall short of that. We do things we wish we didn't do. The good news is that's why he came. That's the rescue mission he's on. It's that he's come to rescue people who are caught up in what the Bible calls sin. And he's come to restore us to God. Well, I think we're brought up to believe the Christian message is try hard, be good, be better. And if you're good enough, then maybe God will love you. Mm. Well, that is very disappointing. Because if that's the message, then what hope for us? I'm never going to be good enough. I've got to come up to the standards of Jesus. No, the message is he has come to forgive people who actually are like me and not perfect. Mm.
Okay, thank you. Now,
the other sort of section. Oh, do you want to...
The other section, yes. One of the things we do at Emmanuel is just to give people time to come back from the questions that they've asked and what Mike has responded. Now, we don't always have time to do that, but this time we're making some time. So I'm sure you've got other questions, or you may want to come back to Mike about that before I move on to the next section, which was about sort of the reliability of the Gospels. But who's got a question? Just raise your hand or a comment you want to make a bit further. Or if you want to make a comment on a friend, maybe.
Not a comment, as we sometimes say.
A comment for a friend. Yes, a comment for a friend. Yes, maybe you want to comment on the person who brought you. Just wave your hand. Otherwise, we can move. Oh, there's one at the back. Yes, right. I will run with the back.
Okay, go on then.
Story not being recorded much for those the missing years. Yeah. There are stories about him that I've kind of heard about, that maybe he went travelling through India and places like that. Is there no evidence of that kind of written? I'm a real novice to this.
Great to have you here. I think that's right. We've all seen the Channel 4 documentaries about, you know, Jesus went to live in India and those kind of things. And I don't know of any serious ancient historian who takes that seriously. They usually sort of come under the umbrella of conspiracy theory. Something's been hushed up, and someone has found something that no one else, you know, is prepared to acknowledge, and it leads to a story of Jesus living in India or those kinds of things. It's hard to kind of to prove a negative. It's just I don't know of any evidence that that happened. If that did happen, then it means all the evidence we do have about Jesus is not right. So I think the weight of evidence, both within the Bible but also from non-Christian writers, would suggest that Jesus didn't go and live in India. That's all born of the idea that he survived the crucifixion and was kind of smuggled out. So again, there's all kinds of things it hangs upon. Did he survive the crucifixion? Was he smuggled out to continue his life somewhere else? Did his followers still think he was the Messiah, even though he'd really got quite badly beaten up? So those are the kinds of things it hangs on.
Has anyone else got any comments, or should we move on to the next bit? Yes, one question. Here we are.
I was actually wondering if the resurrected Jesus appeared to people in the last 2,000 years. Why just a few select people and not to others? Hmm. Because even in this age, he appears to people.
Yeah, and I think that's a hard one, isn't it? There are people who would be able to sort of tell a story of a personal experience like that. Interestingly, increasingly from the Muslim world, there's sort of talk of people having dreams or encounters with Jesus, and I don't want to put a dampers on that. I don't want to say, "Well, that can't be right." But what I suppose I want to say is, if it's a question of where does authority lie, what makes something true, and if we just say, "I've just had this kind of unverifiable experience," that makes it true. Well, actually, that's not very strong, because you can have all kinds of dreams and experiences, and you can have too much cheese and have a crazy night and those kinds of things. So we don't want to base the truth of Christianity on a series of mystical experiences. At the same time, I don't want to kind of flatten those who say, actually, I had this extraordinary experience. It's turned me right around. I think there are people like that. But basically, your bread and butter, where do you go to see whether this stuff is true and whether Jesus is alive? In the first instance, I would always send people back to the New Testament. And Jesus says to people in the New Testament, you know, blessed are you who believe because you've seen me, but actually blessed are all those who believe because of what you write down about me. So he's basically, in the New Testament, giving us the foundations for why we should believe in him. Now, God deals with different people in different ways. So I don't want to kind of dismiss people's stories, but I wouldn't say the truth of it all hinges on the fact that someone had a dream. Because we're capable of all kinds of dreams and slightly odd experiences and things like that. Does that help a little bit?
Okay, let's go up. I'm going to swap sides for this section. Okay, this is unrehearsed. We've never done this before. So this is looking at questions that are concerned with the reliability of the accounts that we have. So how can we trust the Bible, that it's a reliable account, to get to know this Jesus?
Yeah, thank you. That's a massive question. Let me just share kind of my own experience of looking into this. And I think my own experience is working backwards. That's to say, the assumption you meet in most people is, look, this is clearly a legend that built up over time. Jesus was a good man, and then over time he sort of came known as a particularly good man. And then you hear the sort of people who've read the Da Vinci Code and books like that say it wasn't until the 4th century Council of Nicaea when they suddenly decided he was the Son of God. And so what is fixed in people's minds is it started as a simple story, and then layer upon layer built up until, you know, in the 4th century, someone said he was the Son of God, and here we are today believing this legend. And that's the kind of way of thinking that makes people think, well, you can't really take the gospel seriously, can you? And I suppose what I want to do is, what I did in my own kind of investigation, was work backwards. Because, the 4th century was not the first time anyone called Jesus the Son of God and worshipped him. He's worshipped in the gospels. And you say, well, when were the Gospels written? Because I remember having supper with a barrister who said, well, the Gospels weren't written until the 2nd century. There's a lot of scope for kind of slippage there. The Gospels were written between about 60 and in the 80s after Jesus. And you say, well, that's still quite a bit of time. If Jesus is sort of crucified in the early to mid-30s and the Gospels aren't written until the 60s to 80s, there's slippage time. But when the Gospels were written, it wasn't the first time someone sat down and thought, now, whatever happened to Jesus of Nazareth? Let's write an account. You see, that would give sort of 30 years of slippage time. Rather, the reason the Gospels are so overlapping is because they're based on common sources, written ones, oral ones. They talk, that the writers of the Gospels talk to the people who were there. They talk to the people who've already been talking about this stuff. And the thing that really struck me in looking at this was I'd always heard that Paul was the guy who made it all up, who blew it all up into something kind of bigger than it ever was. And of course, it turns out Paul was writing before the Gospels were written. See, Paul didn't inflate the Gospels. If the Gospels were written between sort of 60 and 80, Paul was writing between kind of 48 and the 60s. So In Paul's very first letter, in 48, he talks about Jesus as the Son of God. He uses worship language of him. And what he says is he was converted, became a Christian, 14 years before. So in 34. And why did Paul? What happened when Paul was converted? At the time, he was persecuting Christians. Why was he persecuting them? Because they were going around saying that Jesus was to be worshipped. So I suppose one of the things I want to do is kind of redraw the popular story, because the popular story is Jesus was a good man and over time it got inflated. What I want to say is actually, you know, right from the start, the very first Christian said, Jesus is one whom we must worship. That was the very first sermon. So there wasn't time for this kind of legendary sort of layer upon layer thing to build up as some people have it. You still say, yeah, but can we actually trust these documents? I suppose what you do is you
You look at some of the dates, you look at the names, the place names, the people names mentioned in the Gospels, and the ancient historians and the archaeologists say, actually, these tally. Luke is a good historian, for example, and all his social details are spot on, even quite obscure details. Or there are various moments where people thought, well, I don't think that's right, that can't have been right, and then they do a sort of archaeological dig and dig something up and find, oh, Luke did know what he was talking about. So you've got, within the Gospels, you've got information that is connected with the time of Jesus, that knows stuff about places and people, that shows that you're at least dealing with not once upon a time when there were dragons in the land. You've got people writing who knew what they were talking about. So you've got eyewitness account material. Then you say, well, okay, they got the history right, but you know there is all this sort of slippage and development, and their conclusions were wrong or inflated, or what most people say is, but they were biased. So you can't trust them because they were biased. To which I want to say, well, who isn't? Everyone's biased. All history is biased. It's all written from one perspective or another, and you've got to say, well, is this credible? Is it coherent history? Does it make sense? To which you've got to keep going back to that question, how do you account for a group of first century Jews who went round the world and prepared to die for the fact that this crucified man was the Messiah and that all God's purposes were coming to their climax through him. That's what you've got to make sense of. And I don't think there's any reason, I don't think there's any more sensible account than the Gospels. What are some of the other things people sometimes worry about? They say things like, well, have the Gospels been tinkered with over the years? Speaking to someone recently, who said, well, of course, the translation we've got now isn't the original. Well, one of the things is because the Gospels were so in demand, because the early Christians wanted to get them out everywhere, we have so many copies of ancient manuscripts, really old manuscripts, and lots of them, which means we can do the kind of compare and contrast thing, which means when you've got loads of copies of a particular passage, you can say, well, hold on, is there slippage here? Are people making things up? You know, if you've got, two copies of an ancient text, and one says Jesus walked on the water, and the other says Jesus swam through the water, you're not quite sure. Who's having a laugh? You know, did he swim through the water? Or is this some sort of rogue scribe who decided he walked across the water? But if you've got 10 copies, and they all say he walked on the water, and none of them say he swam through the water, you can sort of think, oh, all 10 of them say this stuff. And that's the kind of way you can be sure about what the text said. So, what am I saying? We can be confident about the actual text. I think the whole Gospels are as a legend idea, it's all built on, I think, a shaky premise, which is it started as Jesus was just a good man, and then it all got blown up. That there is no Jesus is a good man tradition. That if Jesus was just a good man, we wouldn't know anything about this. It started with Jesus is the one to be worshipped. And the Gospels seem to, read them. I think that's the best thing to do with them. Read them. What do you make of them? Do they read like myth? Or do they read about people who are accounting real events and real characters? And I think literary critics are very struck by the way that the Gospels are either accurate accounts of real events and real people, or someone has invented the sort of social realist novel about 1600 years before it was invented. They're an extraordinary piece of work. So those are some of the reasons why I take the Gospels seriously. I think they're texts that are in touch with eyewitness accounts, and they're not written far enough after the events for slippage time. And they're part of a culture where getting the story right was very important. If you don't have loads and loads of books, you tell the story verbally, and you don't sort of change it every time you tell it. You tell it right, because then that's what you've got to pass on to those people who tell it to the next people. So in an oral culture, they're very good at getting it right. That's a massive subject. Those are some of the things I would say about reliability of the Gospels.
Just slightly following on from that, do we know anything about who chose what went into the Bible? Who chose what? That's the and what? How do we get the Bible as it is now?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? Because people always worry about things like Gospel of Thomas. They always say, Gospel of Thomas. Why isn't the Gospel of Thomas in? And what we know is that by the end of the first century, towards the end of the first century and just the beginning of the second, you've got a couple of leading Christian leaders who quote the New Testament. The books that we've got in the New Testament pretty much are all quoted and are sort of referred to in the letters and things they write. So you've got this sort of this group of books, our New Testament, sort of up and running and being circulated quite early on. Of course, you all know there was dispute about which books should be in. The dispute arose into the second century when people started saying, people had an agenda. So there's a guy called Marcion who particularly had an agenda, and his agenda was he wanted to get rid of all the things that looked like they were sort of had a Jewish feel to them. And he was getting quite a sort of head of steam up. And because of what he was saying, everyone had to sit down and say, no, what really should go into the New Testament? Because he's saying this stuff shouldn't be in it. So that raises the issue, well, what should? And the way the early church answered that was not, you know, these are the ones we fancy, but to ask the question, what can be traced back to the apostles? In other words, what can be traced back to people who had first-hand experience of Jesus? That was the kind of question. What they didn't decide this is authoritative. They said, what has always been regarded by the church as authoritative? In the way that even within the New Testament, Paul's writings are talked about as scripture, because they're recognized as having an authority, because they're written by someone who had first-hand experience of Jesus. So when you look at some of the non-biblical writings in the early church about what really mattered to them, was, does it go back to the apostles? Because they want to be sure that the records are accurate. See, we like innovation, whereas their big thing was, can we be sure this is accurate? So people didn't just sort of sit down and go, we don't like that one, we quite like that one. But there were debates, and the debates were caused by people like Marcion, who said, let's get rid of Matthew's gospel, we don't like that, because that he was very anti-Jewish, this guy. But they put him back in his place and said, no, we must stick with Matthew's gospel.
Okay, there's one more before we go on to the next section. And I'll also open it up for any questions as well, so please think of those. If Jesus was prefigured in the Old Testament, isn't it more likely that the combination of the striking teacher who Jesus was, plus the Jesus-shaped hole, provided the gospel version of his life? So in other words, a creation theologian in the first century could have made it up.
Someone could have made it up. Yeah, I'm not quite sure why. As in, I think I'd ask that question as to why someone could have made it up. I think what's striking, though, is that in terms of what you're saying, do you mean is the person saying made up the whole thing? Jesus never existed, and they just invented this figure. I think I'd very strongly want to say, no, hold on. Look at even the records outside of the Bible about Jesus' existence. But you might be saying you made up this portrait of Jesus. Jesus was just a good man, another guy, and he was a useful vehicle, a way of therefore making out as though the promises of old had been fulfilled. I mean, that may be what the questioner is implying. To which I just want to say, well, the people who first proclaimed this news died for it, mostly. And it's one thing to kind of die for something you really believe in, but die for something you know is fiction, that you made up. It's not a very good story, in the sense of, if you wanted to capture the world, if you're making up a story that goes, come and follow our man who is the Son of God, and he was crucified by the Romans, that's hopeless. It's hopeless because if you're a Jewish person, being crucified is associated with being cursed. If you're a Roman person, well, the lowest of the low were crucified. So if you're going to tell a story that's going to kind of capture people to your movement, that's not a good one to make up. I think that would be my sort of main question I'd want to explore with someone who said it's made up. It's not a very good story to make up. It's so kind of counter the culture of the ancient world. If you were going to say, let's start a revolutionary movement, let's sort of piggyback on the back of Jesus and paint him to be a political revolutionary,
Well, you'd draw him in different colours, and you'd certainly cover up the bit about the cross and not spend a third of the Gospels on it. But what's striking, though, is no early Christian, there's no strand of political revolution in any early Christian teaching. So I'm not quite sure how that would work, the idea of it being made up. It just doesn't... it's not a very good story, I think, is what I'd say.
Okay, so before we move on to the last section, who's got any sort of comments on that, or any another question, or a question from a friend, or one from Austin? Austin.
Just to comment on that last point, really, if someone had made it up, it would negate all of our experiences. So even the experiences in this room of all the Christians here, much less all those of people across the world for all these centuries, we wouldn't have the experience that we have that backs up our knowledge. If someone had made it up.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's part of the answer, is if it was just a story, what do Christians mean when they talk about, I know Jesus? You know, we've got all kinds of favourite characters in novels, but do you know Diggory Venn? Or you just read about him in Thomas Hardy? Do you know what I mean? We say we don't just know about him. Christians, the testimony of Christians for the last 2,000 years is we know him. Yeah, thank you, Austin.
So this isn't an auction house, so don't just scratch your nose. I won't come over. Actually, wave your hand so I can see who the questions are. Yes, all right, thank you.
Just to comment on Austin's comment, I don't want to pick a fight, but you could say, although if he wants to pick a fight. you could say, but... So if Christianity claims to be the true religion, then you could say, but lots of people have experiences of other religions, and does that make them right as well? Are we all right in our experiences?
Yeah. But our experiences are part of what you have to reckon with. So you say, hold, these people have had this experience. What is it based on? What is it founded upon? Where does it come from? What's the shape of it? So we don't just rule out experience. Experience is part of the data that we reckon with. And you tell me you've had some crazy dream about a pink unicorn, and the pink unicorn has told you to go to Australia. And I will once say, well, tell me about that. Can you make sense of that? What sort of worldview is that part of? How does that connect with anything that's happened in history? Or have you just say, no, it's just my dream. Therefore, believe me. Well, then that doesn't quite have the kind of authority and the weight. But if people are talking about an experience of knowing Jesus and being forgiven, that also fits, it coheres with what the Bible teaches about the kind of experience that we would be led to expect, then that's part of how I'd sort of look at the data. Nicholas, I'm just quite conscious that time presses on, waits for no man.
No man is an island.
No man is an island. Do we... Should we just do one more, and then we probably need to let the children
in? All right, let's do this one. We've got more. Yeah, there are some others about the passage, but here's one. Is it not arrogant to claim that Jesus is the only way and the only judge? What about other religions?
Yeah, thank you. It's certainly very striking, isn't it? Because the one thing you can't, there's no wriggle room with Jesus. Jesus is not just saying, here's a way, here's an idea. He is making absolute and quite exclusive claims. Is it arrogant? Well, we live in a culture that thinks it is arrogant to make truth claims. And I'm suggesting, again, we've sort of lost our way on that a little bit. We just say there's your story and my story and everyone's story. And of course, the tragedy of that is if it's your story and my story and her story and his story, no story is true. We're all just whistling in the dark. It's not inherently arrogant to make a truth claim. To say that, I don't know, Paris is the capital of France is not arrogant. I mean, you think, well, that's ruling out all kinds of other good cities in France. That it's possible to assert the truth without being arrogant. The question is, by what authority do you make that assertion? And it's not... Jesus' claim is to be the way to God. Now, of course, in our culture, that sounds arrogant. But the question to sort of follow up is there any basis for taking that claim seriously? Am I being arrogant when I say Paris is the capital of France, or do I make that claim based on good authority? Because it's possible for something just to be true. And I think that's an approach that's That's alien to us in our culture, where we want to say everything's true, everything's right. Although we don't quite live with that, because we still want to say, no, that's not right. So just because someone makes a truth claim doesn't mean it's arrogant. There would be an arrogant way of making it. Because I'm just very conscious of all the youngsters there.
Yep.
And I'm very conscious that we haven't even prayed. What should we do? I think we probably need to have the youngsters in, because they're waiting so kind of patiently. Listen from them, and we'll jiggle prayers around.
Yep. And right. Perhaps I could add, if you had some, there were some questions we didn't get round to asking, please either ask the person sitting next to you, or if you want to come and ask Mike as well, then please do that so you can have your question answered. But I'm sorry, there just wasn't time to ask all of them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.